Hello, I'm Neil Shepp.
And I'm Katie Holmes, and this is Don't Do That, Do This, a podcast bringing stories of growth from the Middle East for companies that are either based here or looking to move to Dubai, brought to you by the British Chamber of Commerce, Dubai.
Today, we have Marissa Peer, a world-renowned speaker, rapid transformational therapist and best-selling author. Marissa has spent over three decades treating a client list that includes international superstars, CEOs, royalties, and Olympic athletes. Today, we're talking about growing a successful community and building a resilient and positive mindset. Before we jump into the interview, we've got some great growth stories coming up, so make sure you subscribe and follow us on social media. This podcast wouldn't have been possible without the following teams. Rightfully for storytelling and thought leadership, Studio Red for the quality podcast studio and video production, and Sherbet Lemon for branding, social media design, and editing. Marissa, thanks for being with us. We're so excited to have you on. We've got loads of conversation and questions.
Well, thank you for asking me. I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you, Marissa. So at the beginning of each of our podcasts, we ask everybody what their favorite biscuit is. So would you like to share what your favorite biscuit is?
My favorite biscuit is a hobnob. I don't even know why. I think it's because they're very crunchy. They're not excessively sweet. But I think really it's because my grandmother used to give me those. So it's, you know, food is very linked to regression, very linked to memory. So it's a lot of happy memories about hobnob.
Thank you for sharing that. So now we're going to launch straight into our questions.
Yeah. Okay. It'll be good. It's funny. I was at dinner back at home this week, and we've got our family over. So we have my sister-in-law, my brother-in-law, and my in-laws. And we're just sitting down having dinner. I was like, yeah, you know, I'm really excited about this week's podcast interview. We have Marissa Peer, and my sister-in-law just jumped straight into it. She's like, wow. I've done her training program. I was like, great, tell me about her. And so what a small world.
Such a small world.
That she's done your 12-month training program, and the inside info is she learned a lot, she got a certificate, and she's excited about your program.
Yeah, so it's a small world, but also RTT is getting bigger all over the world. So we're finding more and more people that know about it, have done it. So we meet people all over the world now that know about it, which is...
Yeah.
Actually, a really lovely thing.
Could you tell us a little bit about, I mean, we've done our research, but those that are listening, could you tell us a little bit more about
RTT is?
Yes.
So RTT stands for Rapid Transformational Therapy. And of course, the consensus was that therapy isn't rapid. It's long, it's quite arduous, and it's a big commitment. But I always didn't really understand that, because every therapeutic modality, whether you're going to a doctor or a dentist or even a chiropractor, is let me get you out of pain as fast as I possibly can. And I always thought therapy should be the same as every other healing modality. Let me get you out of pain faster. So, and a lot of my clients would give me feedback and say, you know what you did or what you said, or I've been in therapy for 10 years, but you sorted it out in an hour. And I heard that more than I heard anything else. How come you understood me so quickly? Because I made it my purpose to understand what makes people tick and how to change that. So I created RTT. And we trained nearly 17,000 people, including your sister-in-law, all over the world to do this amazing therapy that is rapid, but it's also incredibly transformational, because it's working really on the basis of why humans do what they do. And it just isn't true. You know, when I was training, I was with my very eminent teacher saying, you know, the mind is very complicated. It takes a lifetime to understand it. And another lifetime to apply it. I'm like, well, that can't be true, because why would the universe go, here's a great brain, and as you get to 90, you might just work it out, unless you believe massively in reincarnation.
Yeah.
What's the point of that? And it simply isn't true. The mind isn't complex. It's very easy to understand why we do what we do and how to change it. So RTT is based on, in the first session, in the first 10 minutes, you're going to go back and find out why you do what you do. And then we're going to change it. And that's actually really, really easy when you understand how to do it.
Just interested to know, from a kind of male and female split, what is the, does it work better for male or female?
I mean, it works the same for everybody, male, female, old, young, children. we have probably 70% more women coming to train than men, probably because therapy is one of the few careers that is very kind to people with children. You can start work at 10, you can finish at 3, you can work from home. There aren't many careers. It's a woman, hey, this fits in entirely around child rearing or dealing with other issues, and you can do it part-time. You can pick your hours, very flexible, even pick your fee. So we have more women than men, but actually men are really needed in therapy because I work with so many kids who have no father, go to school, and the teachers are mostly female, and then they go to the therapist is also female. So we're taking on a lot. We've just created a sponsorship for men, particularly because we really need them so much in the therapeutic world.
Fantastic. And may I jump in now just to go in about the schools programs that you're working on in Dubai? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, my father was a head teacher, so my passion has always been, you know, work with children. You know, I see as a therapist every day what happens, because until the age of 5, children have no logic, only feeling. And so a child who has got an absent father or an unhappy mother can't say, well, my dad's working, my mum's super stressed. They can only think, oh, they're unhappy, it must be my fault, I guess I'm not enough. And we have a second business, we created the I'm Enough movement, because, you know, once children buy into I'm not enough, they don't suddenly get to 20 and go, oh, that wasn't true, or even 30 or even 40. So I always wanted to put myself out of business, you know, to get to the next level so that we don't need therapy. And I think every therapist should think that should be my motivation. Let me put myself out of business by creating something for children. And so we created 3 programs. One is a 5-day I can't or I can challenge. One is an anti-bullying program. One is a COVID program for children that were so scared of it. And then we started to introduce it to schools. We've got about 3,000 schools already using it who all say the same thing. It's amazing. It's rapidly raising the children's self-esteem and sense of self-worth. And then when that happens, academically they do better anyway. So when I came here, I had so many schools saying, we want it, we'll take it, we want it everywhere. One of the reasons we moved here was because if you get something into Dubai, you kind of get it into the whole world because it's 92% expat. So I was at a school last week doing it with 7 to 11-year-olds from every country. And it was so wonderful to work with these children and just show them how to raise their self-esteem.
Wow, I can see how that's going to be transformational.
It's incredible, yeah.
Go through, as I shared with you earlier, I grew up in a spiritual organization. And, you know, my week's classes was about self-esteem, self-confidence, meditation. And whilst, honestly, I don't practice it as much as I should have, I know it's part of me from that age. And when I think about my own kids, and often me and my wife, we talk about this, which is we're missing that community. We're missing that education
from
young age. And now it's just about iPads and what's on TV and watching Christmas movies. But it's not the spiritual side.
Yeah, that's a huge challenge, because our greatest need is to be connected. When we're born, we have 2 drivers: find connection, avoid rejection, because that's how we survive on the planet. And all our life, we still have that drive to find connection, avoid rejection, because if you have connection, you're less likely to die if you belong to a tribe or a community. And not long ago, survival was a numbers game. How big is the group you belong to? And you're going to be okay. Now we live in a world where we're finding disconnection everywhere we go. And as you say, kids are on their phone, they're on their iPad. And of course, here they're moving all the time. So they make friends and then they have to leave. And I've worked with many kids who say, I just stopped making friends because I couldn't stand saying goodbye anymore. So I just learned not to connect. So it's an interesting problem that we're creating all over the world, this epidemic of disconnection.
Yeah, and I can definitely, I mean, one of my daughters has lost 3 best friends, and she's only just turned 11, that have gone elsewhere. And you always encourage them, say, well, you still stay in contact, but they don't.
And they know too that, that happened to my daughter when she was 11, her best friend went back to New Zealand, and she kind of knew that she wouldn't see her again. Very hard.
And it must be the same for adults, you know, we're here making friends, trying to make a life for us.
Yeah.
But the detachment is real. And We've got quite a few divorce lawyers in our membership and been hearing that the divorce rate is through the roof at the moment.
Wow. Yeah.
So, I don't know. I know you do a lot with relationship therapy as well. What can you sort of apply in your early experience of...
comes back again to self-esteem. I mean, my father was an amazing head teacher and always said the job of a school is to raise children's selves. So forget about Latin. It's to raise kids' self-esteem. And actually, then I learned that the job of a parent is the same. It doesn't matter how much organic broccoli or mandarin you teach your kids. Your job is to raise children with high self-esteem. So if we did that, you could imagine the generation coming up will have high self-esteem. They would be less likely to get divorced because divorce is about you don't meet my need, you don't love me, you're not there, you're not injured, you're always at work or you're always at the kids. And a lot of divorce is about people just feeling not heard. You know, that classic, my wife doesn't understand me, my husband doesn't listen to me. So if you had children with high self-esteem, everything would change. Bullying would practically disappear. And people would work out their marriage. You know, when I married my husband, there's a great saying called, I love you, let's work it out. And we always committed that we were never going to threaten to leave. I'll leave if you do this, or I'm off if you say that. And it's a shame when marriages end, but a lot of marriages end. I find a lot of my clients who get divorced marry someone else, and it's no better because they didn't fix the issues that were all about, you don't understand me. And so I do a lot of coaching with people about how to express your needs. So when you're in a relationship, you're going to have to put your needs in three buckets. So one bucket is, okay, this is non-negotiable. I need to know what time you're coming home. You need to call me. I don't want you to be drinking. I mean, we all have to choose, but we have one group of non-negotiable needs. And then we have a second group of needs. Like for me, I need a tidy kitchen, right? I've just worked out. It's easier to do that myself. My husband doesn't even see mess. So you can't say to a messy person, look at this, it's so disordered. They go, what mess? They don't see it. So the third set of needs is, could you meet that yourself? You know, same thing with my daughter. She's very messy. I just learned to shut the door to her room because she's an artist, again, doesn't even notice mess. And then there's a third set of needs, and you have to give those up. I need, you know, someone to always be there and always and put me first. And eventually you realize that you're never going to find anyone ever to meet all your needs. So you have non-negotiable needs. These must be met. I can meet these needs. You know, say you wanted a dog. And so I want a dog and your partner doesn't. You go, well, I have to commit then. I'm going to be the one who walks it all the time. I have to meet that need myself. It's not fair to say, well, I've got the dog now. You need to walk it. It's dark. It's raining. But it's also very important to give up some needs. So what's more important, to be right or to be happy? It's always more important to be kind than it is to be right. And I work with a lot of suicidal children who always say the same thing. I'm always made wrong. So when you're right, someone else is wrong. And so one of the best things in a marriage or a relationship is you don't have to be right. You just have to be able to say what you're feeling and let someone else have their point of view too. So my husband and I have this great thing that works for us, and it's called I'm telling myself the story. So we were driving in the car. I think I was driving. My husband was looking at his phone. And I started to talk to him and he was looking at the phone. And I was like, chat, chat, chat. And then, so I said, you know, I'm telling myself a story here that you're not listening to a word I say because you're more interested in your phone. So I wouldn't do the, you don't care about me. You're always on the phone. I'm talking, not even answering. It's so rude. How do you think I feel? I just said, I'm telling myself the story here. He said, oh, and I'm telling myself the story because I've just got an email from our accountant saying our business account has been hacked and I'm trying to sort this out. And I'm like, oh, if only my wife would just leave me alone. I'm trying to write to the accountant. And so I was telling someone that story and someone wrote in and said, oh, your husband's lying to you. He's obviously having an affair.
Wow.
The bank doesn't send you an email. So now we've got a third story. So we each had a story, but actually, he wasn't talking to the bank. He was talking to our accountant. So the person who very kindly wrote in and said, oh, your husband's lying. He must be having an affair. Don't you know the banks never email me? It was actually the accountant. But I thought that was quite funny. Now I've got three stories. My husband's not listening. I wish my wife would live with it. And he's definitely having an affair. So when you can say to someone, I'm telling myself a story that you don't care about me because it's my birthday, you haven't mentioned it. And they can go, well, You know, my story is I don't care about birthdays. They're not, you know, my husband doesn't care about birthdays. I do. It's a big deal for me. But if you can always start your conversation with, not you did or you said or you always or you never, but I'm telling myself a story that you don't care about me because you haven't even mentioned my birthday, which is next week. And then they can come back and say, oh, well, I'm planning a surprise, or I didn't realize it was such a big deal. I thought as you got older, we wouldn't mention it. But marriages would work if you could just get into a better way of communicating. You know, we're all taught that. If only you can learn to talk to someone. But, you know, no one teaches you great relationship skills. How do you communicate with the other person? What do you say when they're super annoying? But there are much better ways of doing it than you don't love me anymore.
We recently, as a family, did the five love languages to work out how everybody was. And it was so fascinating. But it wasn't just a one-off exercise. Ever since then, we've all been talking about it.
Yeah.
And I remember I went through a training. It was, don't treat others how you want to be treated. Treat others how they want to be treated. Yeah, it's a little bit like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Understanding how to get what you want without being completely...
Yeah.
fixated, but understanding how they would want information presented to them. And that's very much in business as well.
Yeah, yesterday I came home and I had a great conversation with this guy that I was introduced to. I said to my wife, I've had this great conversation. She said, just tell me about it. And then the next second she walked away. She said, I just need to do something with the kids. This was the last part. And then she came back and she said, yeah, tell me about it. And she said, oh, one sec. Just kind of, I was like, why is it every time I'm trying to explain this story to you, you just walk away and our brother and sister were just laughing. And she finally came back and she sat down on the sofa next to me and she had her phone up. She goes, yeah, tell me about it. I said, no, I'm not going to tell you about it until I get 100% attention. But I like the approach that you just said.
Yeah.
I'm going to use that.
Yeah. And then you also have to say to someone, I say to my husband, do you have a few minutes? I want to talk to you about something. I'll wait till you finish on the phone. My husband says, can you turn your phone the other way round? He's even more like, I said, can you come off the phone? He's like, if you've got a few minutes, turn your phone off, put it over there, turn it, put it somewhere else.
Exactly.
So you have to ask for your needs, but it comes back again to high self-esteem because we'll have this belief that the perfect partner is a psychic and they know exactly what you want in bed, what you want in the house, what you want for your birthday. And of course they don't. So when you can say, I like this and this makes me happy. And I find what works for me a lot too. I'll say to my husband, how can I be a better wife for you? And he'll go, oh, okay. And he'll give me a list of things. When we're in a mow, don't walk off, you know. Tell me, I'm just going in there and always have your phone on. That drives him crazy. He tries to ring me and I'm not answering it because he makes me switch it off at night and then I forget to switch it on in the morning. I said, well, you didn't make me switch it off, but now we have this thing about keeping it outside the room. And when he's finished, I go, okay, I can do it. Now this is how you can be a better husband for me. So it's a much better way. What needs of yours can I meet? And then, by the way, these are my needs that you could meet, but they're never going to meet all your needs.
We'd love to hear from anyone listening if they put that, I'm telling a story into practice and it's helping them.
I'm telling myself a story.
Telling myself this story.
Yeah, because it's not true, but, you know, and then you think, oh, so that's yours. So... I had another event when we'd just flown in from Mexico to LA and they lost my luggage and I was really upset. I was standing, I had to go somewhere to United somewhere else and they were trying to, and my husband said, oh, I've got an Uber coming now. And I'm like, well, you go home if you want to. I need to find my bag. And he's like, oh, I was trying to be, his story was, my poor wife, she said, let me get an Uber ready. I can whisk her away, make her lunch and then the bag will turn. My story was, oh, you just want to go home. You don't even care about my luggage. I haven't lost your luggage. They've lost mine. You just want to get out of here. It's not important to you. But you see how we both had a story. And my story was not his story. And his story wasn't my story. So I really recommend you use it because it helps a lot.
And it's the meaning that you're applying to the story you're telling, right?
Yeah.
Because like you had those three examples. You gave one meaning.
Yeah.
But just asking, and I used to do this. It brings back memories, actually. I used to do this, use this technique, and I used to ask myself, whenever I'd get emotional about something, I'd say, this is the meaning I'm applying. What other alternative meaning
would
there be?
Yeah.
And the moment you ask yourself that question, you try to answer it, suddenly your emotions go down.
Especially if you have teenage kids that go, oh, for God's sake, or you're so pathetic. And you go, wow, I can't believe you spoke about that. They go, Mum, I speak to everyone like that. Oh, my story is my kid is disrespectful. Their story is, this is how I talk to my friends. I say things like, you're so lame, you're so ridiculous, you're so whatever. They have so many different words they keep inventing.
Keep up.
But they're not being disrespectful. And also, when they argue with you, you should be thrilled they do that, because that's how they learn to go around the world and have an opinion.
Yeah.
And the last thing you want is a kid, especially a girl, who says yes to everyone, can't argue back. Like my daughter's like, Mummy, how do you make a boy like you? I said, disagree with everything they say. They say, I like football, say, I like cricket. If they say, I like pizza, say, I like pasta. But have an opinion.
Yeah.
Be a bit sparky. Do not be a yes person. Because so often we don't. We say, don't argue with me. I've said it, so it's right. Then we wonder why our kids go out and go, well, my friend said I should shoplift. My friend said I should take drugs. Because you said, do not argue with me. You do what I say. You want to let them argue with you a lot. Because then they go out in the world with their own opinion. And you're the one they practice on.
Going into a workplace environment as well. So we talked about this in the pre-briefing about it's, you know, if you're kind, which is the, you know, expression you're using before, does it stop you going to a certain level in business? Are you seen as, is it a weakness when somebody's seen?
I think in business, there are two reasons of being kind. You're kind because you're a kind person. You're a nice person. You go out of your way to help people. That's being kind. But then if you're kind because you want everyone to like you and approve of you and you're always giving to people, then that's the wrong reason to be kind. And, you know, you can be too kind. When I started my dialysis life program, people would write to me and go, how many calories are in an avocado? And I'd write back, and then I think they write me, how many calories are in it? And I'm like, I'm not Google. Why are you writing me? You can Google that. You're writing and I'm taking my time to write back. So eventually said, I'm not Google. I don't answer questions. You can Google all of that, because sometimes you can be kind and people see it as a weakness. It's like, you know, babysitting for someone else's kids. The more you do that, the more they ask you to do it. So it's good to be kind, but it is seen as a weakness in the workforce. You know, we've trained 17,000 therapists, and a lot of therapists have that. I'm such a kind, giving person, and I take calls. People will ring me night and day. And you have to have boundaries. I'm kind, but I've also got my own life. You know, I don't take calls at 11 o'clock. I don't take calls on a Sunday. By all means, you can ring me up and discuss your progress, but I'm not really going to be a sounding board every time you have an argument with your husband or your wife or your kid. So I think it's wonderful to be kind. Kindness is such an underrated thing. One of the reasons I married my husband was because he was so kind. And I knew I'd be happy with him because he is immensely kind and always put me first. But even though I recognize what a great asset it is in the workforce, people can take terrible advantage of you. You see you as kind because they see you as weak. Oh, they won't complain because they're kind. They'll stay late, come in early, give up their lunch break. And we push people as far as they allow themselves to be pushed. As long as you have to say, none.
And is it because, and this is a great topic, right? And we can see that it's a great topic because this was a video you did 3-4 years ago on YouTube, why nice people finish last.
Yeah.
And I think it got 1.4 million views. So it's one of your most popular comics. And is it that if you're kind, there's one angle, which is around being walking all over someone. You know, they're going to move based on my needs, and that person's kind. So that's one side. The other side is when you come across managing directors or, you know, large founders, and you know, there's this authority, there's this air that they carry with them, and it's because they're not necessarily, maybe they are kind in person, but they don't give that off.
Yeah.
So is there a connection between that? Not being kind and not appearing to be kind, and having almost this gravitas behind you and this arrogance almost.
You know, arrogance is just the other end of the scale of low self. That was a seesaw. You'll have somebody here who's got low self-esteem, and someone here who's arrogant, but they're both in the same place. The bit in the middle is called honoring yourself. So a person who's arrogant, say this is an arrogant person, they actually feel that they're slightly down here and that everyone else is somewhat superior. They only have two choices now, diminish you or embellish myself, because they don't want that. They want that. They want to be superior, because an arrogant person doesn't feel good about themselves. They're not trying to prove to themselves they're good. They're trying to prove it. And they say things like, well, no one in my family is divorced. I went to a better school than you. I never do that. And the problem is that if you don't have a lot of high self-esteem, you can't really embellish yourself. You can only keep diminishing the other person. So no bully wakes up and goes, oh, my life is so amazing. Who can I diminish today? No one says, I'm so happy. I'm going to go onto Google, go onto YouTube and write horrible comments about somebody. So we have to recognize that people who are diminishing have very low self-esteem. And critical people always have the most criticism reserved for themselves. So that's their agenda. I don't like myself. If I diminish you, then we're equal now. You know, a miserable person makes another person miserable, then they feel a bit more equal. But then you have the other end, which is someone who is nice may lend you money and never ask for it back. And then people say, well, they never asked for it. They didn't need it. They didn't want it. They lent me their coat. They never asked for it back. So I just kept it. And when they asked for it back, I'm like, oh, I've had it for 2 years now. I didn't think you wanted it. It's kind of become mine. So we're both at fault. Arrogant people are insecure. And many people who are overkind are also insecure. And then they sort of meet head on, and they both aren't really being honest about what's going on. The arrogant person's never going to say, actually, I feel so insecure. And the kind person's not going to say, me too, so I'm trying to buy your friendship, show you how nice I am. Because in a world where you're trying to please everyone, you really have to do that thing. You have to please yourself, honor yourself. You have to learn to say, no, now I'm not going to do that. We have to have boundaries. So people are always lending people stuff and never getting it back. You have to learn to say no. And also a very good thing to stop being overkind is to stop saying, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry I'm late. I'm so sorry I don't understand this. I'm so sorry I've got, I'm sorry I'm so ill. And to say, thank you so much for waiting. Thank you so much for explaining this to me. Thank you so much for looking after me when I was having a bad day. So if you feel that you're being overkind, the fastest way to stop that or to get balance is to stop apologizing. Sure, if you make a mistake, say, well, I'm really sorry, I didn't realize.
Because you're losing your
value. Yeah. When you apologize all the time, you're making that happen. You're diminishing yourself in the eyes of others. They see it, but you see it too. So it's a very simple switch. Thank you so much, as opposed to I'm sorry.
And I think you can also lose your value when you're being too nice.
Oh.
I'm being too kind. I've been to many British business group events, and it's strange. I'm often looking at the dynamics, and you know, me as an individual, I'll talk to everyone, but then there'll be a few that will be slightly standoffish. They'll talk to a few people, but in the back of my head, I've got, she must be really important. There must be something there.
See, what the story you're telling yourself, yeah, we'll see.
And I feel like it's not just me. I feel like everyone else is telling the story, and they're going, this person must have something about
it. Yeah. Or it's that, yeah, I mean, like we know through our membership is that there's so many people that really fear networking. And often I think it almost debilitates them that they're there in a room and they don't even know how to make the conversation.
Yes.
But it's, if they knew what the perception was of them, it's quite interesting. It's such a polar opposite, isn't it? I mean, I was working with a company about 6 years ago, and they asked me to come and work with them. And the boss was a little bit standoffish. My husband said, oh, he really doesn't like me. But then as I got to know this person, he said he's autistic. Wow. I mean, I'm not sure if that's true. It's a great excuse. But actually, the more I know him, and now we are the best friends. I love this person. He loves us. But my first impression was, oh, he's very cold. And my husband's first impression was, oh, he definitely doesn't like, he likes you, but he doesn't like me.
Mm.
And that was completely wrong. He's just a person that doesn't like to be bombarded with people,
is
likes his own company and believes he's got a degree of autism, which might not even be true. But it's so interesting that he's telling you, I don't like people. So one of my classmates said, I have social anxiety. I said, you do not. You just don't like people. Why not say, I don't like people?
Yeah.
That's okay. And then you say, I don't like people. I don't go out a lot, but sometimes I do. But telling yourself you have social anxiety makes it worse. So with networking, it's hard if you've told yourself the story of no one's interested in me. I got nothing to say. One of the reasons I called my last book, Tell Yourself a Better Lie, which is that was always thing, is when you go out and think, oh, I'm going to go to this. No one's going to speak to me. I've got nothing to say. Everyone's more important. My boss is going to be there. I really messed up when I speak to people. I go bright red. I don't know what to say. I start fiddling with my fingers. If you're going to tell yourself a lie, tell yourself a better one. When I go to networking meetings, I've got something to say. Mm-hmm. I've got something valuable to offer the world. Not who am I to not, who am I to do this? It's who am I not to? Because connection is what our DNA requires, connection. But before you go to anything, you should always take a minute and say, I've got something to say. I'm a great person. I'm warm. I'm smart. I matter. I'm confident. You don't have to believe it. You know, whatever we tell our mind, it begins immediately to make it true. The mind doesn't care if what you tell it is good or bad, helpful or hurtful, useless or useful. It lets it in. And once you learn that, you've got to tell your mind better things. So if you're going to a speaking event and you're the speaker, it's easy to go, oh my God, why did I agree to do that? All these people. What if I dry up? What if? Rather than say, wow, I've got a chance to speak. I've got something to say. If people like me, I'm warm and friendly and I'm actually super smart. You say, well, is that a lie? Who cares? So is the other one. But you might as well tell yourself a better. I mean, I think you should lie, cheat, and steal every day of your life. Lie to your mind, cheat fear, and steal back the phenomenal confidence. When there's a speaker, I see so many people who go, oh my God, I'm so nervous. Look at this crowd. And oh, I'm. And you say, look, it's a great thing to speak. It's a great world. People like you, like them. You're going to tell them something, but you have to give yourself a boost. You know, the most important words you'll ever hear are the words you say to yourself. So in any situation, just take a minute and say, I'm great, I've got this, I'm amazing. You know, Muhammad Ali said, I told myself I was the greatest before I even was. It wasn't even true, but I said it. In fact, what he did was he stated it, he affirmed it, he embodied it. And then we all see him as undefeated, which isn't true. When you say, I am the greatest, even if you don't believe it, you do so much better than saying, I'm the worst, I'm the weakest, I'm not important, I'm deadwood. And Helen Mirren recently said, what is your biggest regret? And she said, not saying, fuck off, so much more. That's my biggest regret. When I was an actress, I couldn't say that. Mm. I know when I started as a female therapist in a world that was very male, and I worked on television with a lot of male doctors and psychiatrists who were sometimes actually condescending. And I didn't realize at the time that I could have said an equivalent of fuck off. Look, just because you say it's true, it's not true. I was on a show many years ago with a doctor, and he was saying, you know, the way to go is all low fat, low fat. I'm like, that's just not true. Low fat is the worst thing you can do. Fat is not your enemy. Fat's your friend. It's sugar. And he really didn't like that. And I said, but later he wrote to me and said, you know, 10 years later, I realized how right you were.
Right.
It isn't, you know, it isn't low fat, it's low sugar. But at the time, he was really kind of very critical and like, oh, you're just a mad therapist. What do you know? I said, well, I know more than you, because clearly this diet you're preaching is the terrible diet. But of course, he was a doctor, so he had precedence. His diet had to take precedence over mine. I was working with all these people who couldn't lose weight because the body doesn't like low fat at all. You know, I was talking about, you know, her camels here. Their hump isn't full of water, it's full of fat. Fat is the thing that works for you. But sometimes when you're doing something new, you'll find often, first they don't like you, and then they kind of agree with you, then they like you. So the guy who discovered septicemia, the guy who wrote Sugar Blues, they were discredited, laughed at, ignored, and then, oh, maybe there's something. But you have to have faith in yourself, even when no one else believes in you. The most important thing is that you believe in you. You know, years ago, I watched X Factor when Simon Cowell said to Will Young, that wasn't good. And he went, Simon, you can't say that wasn't good. It was amazing. And Sam went, you know, well, you're right. It was amazing. Because it was just in his interest to be diminishing. But I love the fact that Will Young said, you can't say that. Mm. You can't say the way I sang Light My Fire was bad. And I love that, the courage he had to come back and say, that's not true.
Yeah.
And when Celine Dion sent her very first audio cassette, I think it was to Sony, and then she called, I think she was 14, said, have you played my music? We don't like it. She said, you haven't even listened to it. You would never hear my voice and say that. They were so surprised that they found it in a pile of unplayed cassettes. I mean, there must have been 1,000, and played it and signed her almost immediately. So in a world where someone else doesn't believe in you, it's your belief that makes the difference. In fact, Meryl Streep went up to play the part of King Kong, and the director said, Meryl, let me tell you the truth. You're not attractive. You'll never make it in this town. And she said, well, that's your opinion. And the scene means I'm going to find another opinion, because you don't have to be beautiful to be a movie star. I mean, that's very nice. But if you look at someone like Judi Dench, or again, Helen Mirren, who were very attractive, but that wasn't what made them amazing. And in fact, if you ever saw Meryl Streep in Out of Africa when Robert Redford washed her hair, she looked immensely beautiful. Danny DeVito was told he would never make it. So was Whoopi Goldberg. So was actually Eminem. He was told, you will never make it as a rapper because you're the wrong demographic. So was Ed Sheeran. But if you have belief, I'm a great believer that belief without talent can take you further than talent without belief. And we see that all the time. People or reality stars, if you haven't got much talent, but extraordinary self. And other people who've got tremendous talent but no belief. But if you can link the two together, I have talent and a belief. Mm. You know, J.K. Rowling, Harry Potter was turned down over and over again. Many people who were really successful were laughed off track and then embarrassed off Shark Tank. The guy who made that little thing, Trunky, which you see all over the world, so this will never be a success. Mm.
How can you apply that for the entrepreneur's journey then? So quite a lot of what you're saying is the sort of matching talent and belief.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's quite a, you know, you can be shaken through your entrepreneurial journey. So what advice would you have for somebody that's either leading a huge team that they might feel a bit of imposter syndrome, and also a founder that's either just starting out their journey or hit a bit of a rocky patch?
Well, your first thing is to really take the time and say, you know, I've got something to offer the world. I have a talent. I have a gift. We all have a gift. Everyone has a gift. You're born with a gift. And in fact, I was thinking life, lovely as it is to find the person and make the children, your job here is to find what your gift is, to really perfect the art of being amazing at your gift and then to monetize your gift. It's a three-step process. And the first step is the easiest, but the most important. Take some time just saying, I have a gift. I've got something amazing to offer. I've got an idea. I've got something here. And keep working on believing in what it is that you have, because it's very hard to sell it if you don't believe in it. So believe in yourself. I've got an idea. I've got a vision. I've got something. And because 80% of success in life is the mindset of, am I worth it? You know, 80% of your success in your career comes down to having the mindset of, I've got something to offer the world. I've got something here. So you got to work on 80%. But most of us don't do that. We're so busy working on trying to show it. So that the step one is to spend a lot of your time saying, I've got something amazing to offer the world. I'm a really good team leader. I'm amazing at speaking. I'm phenomenal. Whatever. I'm phenomenal at selling. I'm a genius at coming up with creative ways. So that's the most important bit. And as you get used to saying that, stating it, affirming, embodying it every day, because I mean, do it when you're in the shower. What else are you going to do in there? Say, I love the smell of this.
Where's my conditioner?
Yeah, I love the smell of this body wash. You can do it when you're waiting for the kettle to boil, before you get out of bed, before you go to sleep, but just start to wire in, maybe when you're in the car. Certain things, I matter, I've got a gift, I'm really good at whatever it is, I'm so good with people, I'm so good at leading a team, I'm so good. And then as you get familiar with doing that, because the mind loves what is familiar, go on to the second part, which is, how can I be even better? Because, you know, anything that you require or pass something of you. So if you're, you know, like we train therapists, but we tell them, well, listen, It's not enough. You want to be a therapist, you have to learn marketing. You are working for yourself now. Mm. And if you don't understand marketing and search engine optimization, then what are you going to do? And so, and for instance, if you want to be a writer, you now have to be a speaker. If you want to create something, you have to, again, understand marketing. But we're so lucky in a world of all these YouTube free tutorials and books. And you can do that. You know, I always wanted to be the best therapist in the UK. But I knew what that involved, which is getting people to write about me. And that's not easy. So the third bit is, okay, here am I. I want to be recognized as an amazing therapist. I know I want that. So what can I do to be an amazing? Always learning, reading, learning more. And then the third step is, okay, now I've got to put that into action. And that's the hard part, because you've got to do what you don't want to do. But if you've done step one, I'm worth it, then you can do the third step, which is asking people to write about you or sponsor you or become a joint venture. And so many people are busy doing step three first. I'm going to find someone. Or doing step two.
So true.
But you have to do step one. So one of my clients is an artist, and artists are very fragile people. And I said, look, you have to learn marketing. Oh, artists don't. I said, I know that, but here's your choice. You want to be an artist or a successful? A successful artist, you must decide how you know. And that involves taking your work into galleries, the hardest thing, because they might say, oh, no, we don't like that. But if you've done step one, I've got something to offer. I'm an amazing artist. And so when she took her paintings into a gallery, there's no, they're not for us. But there's another gallery up the road. They were like that. And so that she got a nice no. And that's the other thing. You have to learn to hear not a denial, but a delay. No at the moment, or no, not for us, or no, quite like that, or no, but someone else will say yes, and the next gallery put it in the window.
Mm.
But none of that would have happened if she hadn't worked on that self-belief.
Yeah, just on that, actually, when in business, there's often, we talk about conversion rates in marketing and growth and sales. And often you'll hear, yeah, if you have 10 sales calls, you should be able to convert three, or yeah, two or three, roughly 20-30%. And I remember a few years ago, I started shifting the story I was telling myself. And it just reminded me of that, which is my wife would say, yeah, did you have that sales call? What happened with that? I say, yeah, it's not going to go ahead. They're thinking about it, but this is now one of that 10,
yes,
which now means I'm closer to the two,
yes,
three,
I'm
going to say yes.
And that's a great reframe. That's you have to reframe everything. Did you really get a no, or did you go to the wrong person, or did you get a no? And the other thing that's so important, because so many entrepreneurs work for themselves, is that we have a praise muscle. And the thing that grows your self-esteem more than anything is praise, praise, and more praise, but your praise. And the thing that diminishes it is criticism. So, you know, that wasn't like we went to work and our boss said, hey, you know, well done. I noticed it is something. I was watching Jamie Oliver, and he pulled aside one young guy. He said, you know, what you did today was amazing. You did that, and that was so innovative and well done. And years ago, our boss or our clients, or if you're a teacher, maybe your student would build your praise muscle. But today, if you work for yourself, who's going to build that? Well, you have to start saying every day, I was amazing today. Even, you know, I didn't get that sale, but I took it so well.
Yeah.
And it motivated me to get the next one. And so you have to think of praise like a muscle. If you're not building it up, you're letting it wither away. Mm. Criticism diminishes your praise muscle, and praise builds it. So if you work for yourself, you have to start saying every day, I was on fire today. I was freaking awesome. Oh, my God, the words that came out of my mouth. I was amazing. Mm. And just keep... Every day, just imagine you are the boss and your job is to build your praise. Yeah, and then keeping that power to yourself.
Yeah.
I suppose we all think we're looking for praise from other people, but if they're telling themselves a story that you've asked praise too much that day or whatever, then it's...
Yeah.
But as soon as you outsource that, can you praise me? Can you might go, yeah, I can. I'm not going to. Mm. But if I give you the job of praising me, if I outsource that now, although you can do it, you can also take it away at a minute's notice.
Yeah.
It's funny. That was the first thought I had, actually.
Yeah.
When you said that, I said to myself, I don't think I can remember to do that. But what if I got Katie to do that with me every day, and I did that with her.
But you could put it on your phone alert. So set your phone alert at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. to say, remember to praise you. You can tell Alexa to tell you, hey, Alexa, remind me.
Tell me I'm amazing.
You could say, before I clean my teeth morning and night, I got to say one. You know, I used to do it with my daughter. She'd come home and I'd say, tell me what you did today that was amazing. And nothing. I could, no, there was something. Mm. I shared my pencil with somebody. Other times she would remember. But it's a good thing as a parent to teach your kids as well. What are you good at? What are you gifted at? Because really, you can never be jack of all trades and master of none. And I think the school system creates a lot of damage because they try to make you good at, they stream people. And, you know, in Scandinavia, you self-select your lessons because you go to the stuff you're good at, which is going to be your career anyway. So much smarter than making kids try to be good at everything. Because again, you're now backed on being a jack of all trades, but a master of none.
Yeah.
So it's good for us, but as parents, when we say to our kid, you know, you're so good at sport. Tell me, well, you're so good at that. But don't focus on what they're not good at. Just focus on what they're good at.
I saw something recently that said if your child is really bad at maths but amazing at netball, get them the netball coach. Don't worry about the maths coach.
Exactly. Because, you know, imagine if we were, I say that to kids, if we were all good at everything, never employ a designer, a decorator, a gardener, we think, well, I can do everything. Mm. And you're only supposed to be good at one thing. But I see so many tormented kids who go, I'm not good at sport, or I'm not good at maths, or I'm only good at IT. It's like, you only have to be good at IT.
Yeah.
You're good at anything else. Mm.
So we've got the three stages that you just talked about. So if I summarize this really quickly. Tell me if I'm right. So we've got stage one, which is believe in yourself, the affirmation.
Yeah, massively believe in yourself.
The phrase you used, telling yourself a better life.
Yeah.
I love that. So that's probably part of stage one. Stage two is having a plan.
Yeah.
Believing in the plan.
Yeah.
And stage three is executing.
Applying it, yeah. Applying.
So let's take that and let's play. And I would love to hear your journey and your story, where how you applied that.
Yeah.
And, you know, from where we sit, you're this super successful speaker, bestseller, you've got this thriving business, but it'd be great to hear, you know, where it all started and what at what point did it shift, where it just exploded.
So I was very ambitious, and I wanted to be the best therapist. So I did that. I want to be the best therapist, but I had to think, what does that look like? And I want to write a book. But when I looked at that, I was, oh, I don't want to write a book. I want to write a best-selling book that changes people's lives. So when you go, I'm the best, and then take a look at what you want, you see it much more clearly. I don't actually want to write a book. I want to write a best-selling book that changes. So then I did a lot of research, and then I went out and offered that book to people. But even before that, when I wanted to be the best therapist, I knew exactly what I had to do. Because if you look at what you want, I thought, well, to be the best, you have to be known. How do you get known? You've got to be in the paper, on the news, on the radio, and in magazines. So I knew exactly what I had to do, which was to call someone, everybody would like to write about me. And believe me, that's not easy. Hello, do you want to write about me? No, I've never heard of you. Goodbye. But as you say, that was the first one. I was very lucky. I think the second or third person, I was reading Men's Health, and they were talking about firewalking. So I called them and said, hey, you know, I'm a therapist, a hypnotherapist. This article is really about mindset, and since you're Men's Health, you should write about hypnosis. And they went, oh, yes, we'd like that. So they said yes. They wrote a piece. It also gave me a column in their magazine. So when you get a yes, you can get another one. So every day I had to make at least one or two phone calls. Would you like to write about me? I just read this piece, and, you know, it says this, but you could say this. I just noticed that you're doing yet again another beach body diet, but how about teaching you what to be a fat burning machine? And so I got a lot of yeses and a lot of no's, but eventually I got more yeses than no's. And then I got a lot of press. In fact, I think I was in a magazine or a newspaper every month for 8 months. Then I had to actually stop doing it because it was actually overwhelming, that volume of press. And then, you know, in a local paper, that'll be picked up. They're syndicated all the time by international papers and magazines. So the mark of successful people is they do what they absolutely dislike to get to where they want to be. So you always have a choice. Shall I do what I don't want to do? And people who fail will give up their goal. They give up their dreams. Oh, I would never do that. That's so embarrassing. That's so uncomfortable. But the trick is the thing, I don't want to do it, so I'm doing it first. If you had to break down the habits of success, where they do what they actively dislike and they do it first. So I always made those calls first. I did it 7 days a week because on the Saturday, the Sunday papers are coming out. And that's another thing, you should take action every day in the direction of your goal. So that was the first thing I did, was to get this press. And then I thought, well, I've got all the press now, so now I can write my own book. And again, you know, when I first wrote it, it's easy to go, oh God, this is terrible. But I'd always have this vision of it being in stores. I said, my daughter's going to be in the window of this shop. And I'd always have this vision of doing book signings. And, you know, I can remember vividly that feeling of hearing that thud when my manuscript came through the door, because they only send it back when they don't want it. It's like, oh, again, I think I heard that thud about five times. But I just had to send it back and send it back because, well, they don't like it, but they're the wrong publisher. Some of them would say, you know, this is good, but, and they tell me why they didn't like it. So I kept working on it. And eventually I got a phenomenal, huge advance for this book and it became a bestseller, but it was rejected a lot. Mm-hmm. But again, it's that same thing. You have to keep going. It's very easy to give up. You know, if you're not choosing to keep going, you're choosing to give up. So what really helped me was getting all the press, all the pieces in the paper, and then getting a book deal, and then getting good reviews for my book.
Did you have an anchor, though, that you would use to motivate yourself to keep going?
I think failure wasn't really an option. I wanted to be a success. And I knew if I didn't do it, I'd always blame myself. You know, I could have tried harder. I mean, like I was saying, I've written a book where it's in a drawer. Oh, I didn't take it to market. I got a rejection. I just gave up. And so many people would do that. But also, I was working as a therapist. I understood exactly how the mind works. You know, you only need to know three things about the mind to get what you want. And one is that your mind does what it thinks you want based on what you tell it. So you go, oh, I can't cope with this rejection anymore. I can't hear another thud as the manuscript hits the doormat. Then your brain will say, okay, just do something else. This is not for you. So you have to be the CEO of your mind and say, okay, just post that back again. I am determined that somebody's going to love this book. This book has something to say. So it comes back again to how you dialogue with you. And I knew the things that made people successful, because I had so many successful clients. And the things they did was, they don't take no for an answer, ever. They always hear no as a no at the moment, or no, not quite like that. So they see it as a delay, not a denial. They take action every day in the direction of the goals. They're very good at building their own praise. This is good, this is great, this is the wrong person for my book. And actually what they said is very valid. And yeah, I can take that on board. So I kept applying the five things that super successful people do, because our belief is, well, that's not me. But you know, you can make it you. You can say, I was born with these beliefs, so I can adopt them. And then my career did sort of take off. I mean, I love being a therapist. I'd have been very happy to be a therapist as long as I was known as an outstanding therapist. But then I got the book deals. And then I started to work on television because I had a lot of clients that were super famous that would say, hey, could you be the therapist on this show? Could you work on this show? And then I was commuting from London to LA every 2 weeks, working on the same show in two different countries. And then, so I was a therapist, a writer, and working on television. And then I began to speak a lot, which I loved more than anything. But people would ring me up and go, hey, you know, I know you're that girl in London. Do you have someone in Alabama or Sydney? And I said, no, there's only me. And then my husband was the one who said, you must teach this. And Wayne Dyer, who knew very well, said something so prolific. He said, don't die with your music still playing inside you. And I was a bit possessive. I was like, no, this is my technique. It's mine. But then I was, of course, you have to share it. It's like, I would never compare myself to Frank Sinatra, but I would say to myself, imagine if he was a plumber or if Beyonce was a nail technician. When you have a gift, you are supposed to share it with everyone. That's why you're here. Find your gift. Monetize your gift. Share your gift, because then you have meaning and purpose. Meaning is when you do what you love, and purpose is when you share it with everyone. So my husband was the one who was the brains behind me having a school because he's a brilliant marketer.
You must have a huge reach. I mean, in terms of...
Massive. Yeah. I think we have 200 million views at the moment and it goes up all the time. So then I created the school, the RTT training school. And the first school was in 2015. 80% of those people are still working now as therapists, which is amazing.
Success rate.
But then I also realized, of course, you know, people have a thing, you know, oh, so we talk about fat cats and rich bitch and filthy rich. But in fact, for me, when I had success financially, I could now create stuff on YouTube and give it away. So this belief is, well, why should you, shouldn't therapists be spiritual people? It shouldn't be about the money, which is, shouldn't be about the money. But the more successful I became, the more I could create the I'm Enough movement. I could create YouTube and Instagram and give tons of stuff away, give away a lot. Yeah, you can have more impact. So a lot of people are scared of success in case people view them as greedy or grasping or, oh, you're just after the money. And in fact, a lot of my clients have this belief that spiritual people shouldn't be successful. But I met someone recently who's so wealthy that he became spiritual. He's like, well, I've got so much money, what shall I do? So he began rewilding swathes of the country, putting in bees and butterflies and growing meadows, because it's like, well, I got a lot of money that I made not being spiritual, but now I can sit back and do spiritual things. So I think we have to get away from, can I make money only being good, being a good, ethical, honorable, wonderful person? But, well, but also, if I made money, I could become a good, honorable, ethical person. Yeah. So
I think a lot of people also, in my experience, struggle to sell themselves.
Yeah.
And stand out. And you don't come across as struggling in that domain, especially being able to just pick up the phone.
But that wasn't easy. You know, that what the great thing about success and liking yourself is it starts with being what you do, but it quickly becomes who you are. And I would be unrecognizable. I mean, when I was 17, I was so insecure, riddled with self-consciousness and insecurity. And now I look back and think, wow, you know, I was that really insecure girl. But the lovely thing about changing yourself is, of course, it's what you do, but then it becomes you. And when you keep affirming, embodying, I matter, I'm significant, I'm enough. And really, of course, you're activating something you were born with. No baby says, don't look at me, I haven't got any hair, I haven't got any teeth, I'm covered in milk spots, I've got triple thighs down here and a massive stomach and a wrinkly, dimply bum. They don't do that. They look at you with their big gums. I think they're the most gorgeous thing in the world. And that's important to think, oh, so all you're doing really is reactivating and remanifesting something you were born with anyway. Again, tell yourself a better lie. No baby says, don't look at me. No abandoned cat says, don't feed me. No abandoned puppy says, oh, I better hide behind the fridge. They bounce out and go, well, how could you not love me? And so it's a wonderful thing to think you were born with that and you can get it back.
Well, but of all the, obviously with your own clients, but then with this huge network, what's the story that springs to mind that's been the most impactful through RTT?
I think it's the not enoughness. You know, I realized very quickly in my career that almost all my clients are millionaires, billionaires, movie stars, Olympic athletes, someone who was a school teacher or a dresser. I would all say the same thing, I'm not enough. And where does that come from? Again, no baby is born believing that. So I realized very quickly that all of my clients across the board only had three things wrong with them. I mean, the three things is an umbrella, but they either didn't think they were good enough, worthy enough, smart enough. And there's so many ways to not think you're enough. Mm. And we can look at someone like George Michael and think, well, you know, he had that with all the talent. Kate Spade, Anthony Bourdain, with all that talent. Philip Seymour Hoffman, what a talented actor. Heath Ledger too, but they all had that thing, I'm actually not enough. And a lot of people who feel not enough are driven to be either rich or famous or both because they think it will make them enough, but it doesn't. So when I noticed how prolific this not enoughness was, that then I created the Not Enough Movement. You might, all these bracelets say I'm enough, and we started giving them away and making podcasts and inviting people to write it all over. I went to a few schools and they've got it all in the playground written in big letters and lots of different languages. Many of the schools I work with make the kids have a little plaque at their desk and they use it in the assembly every day. And so I think it was understanding these categories. So the biggest thing is I'm not enough. The second biggest thing people have is I'm different, so I can't connect. And of course, years ago, when we all lived in tribes, we didn't really have that. But that can be really hard. I'm different, and so I can't connect. And so the head of a company always feels different to all the staff because they have to fire them. Or someone who comes in late and says, well, you know, this team is very established, or you know, I'm a woman leading a team and I feel different, so I can't connect. But it's a belief. It doesn't have to be true. But if you believe it, you make it true. And the third was, I want something. I know it's not available. So we're pursuing a dream with a belief that it's never going to work out. And so I started just fixing all of those things because I had all of those. I definitely felt not enough, not smart enough, not good enough. I mean, my brother and sister went to private school and I didn't because I wasn't the smart one. I went to my father's school, so I definitely had the second one. I'm different, so I can't connect because I went to my dad's school, which looking back was not actually a great thing, but he lived in the village. It was the only school. So I felt not enough because I didn't go to the private schools that my brother and sister went to. I felt different. And I definitely had the third one. It's not available to me because my father, as lovely as he was paid to be interested in other people's kids, and they were always much more important to him than us. So, but when I could look at those things, I think, but you know, none of these are really true, but even if they were true, I can fix them because we make our beliefs, and then our beliefs make us, and we have confirmation bias, we start looking for proof. So everyone here, you can think, okay, I made a belief, I'm not good enough, I don't matter, I'm not good at speaking, I can't rise at the top. What if I get this job and everyone realizes I'm a failure? What if I get success and it's still a disappointment? So once you made your beliefs then make you, and then you look for proof of what you have chosen to believe and you always find it. So the trick is to think, well, why don't I make a better belief then? You know, a belief is nothing more than a thought you think a lot. So for me, stratospheric change was when I changed a belief. I got offered some television work and I learned to say yes. You know, I got offered another book deal. I'm thinking, oh, I don't have a second book. I don't even know what to write. I've only got one book. And I said, yes, I'll do all of that. And I had no idea how I would do it. But you can always come back and say no. You can change a yes to a no. It's much harder to change a no to a yes. So I get offered a job on television. Yeah, sure. And half the time I didn't know what I was doing. I think, oh my God, why am I saying yes to this? But it's a good idea to do that because you can never know what your potential is because your potential expands as you move towards it, then it expands again and again. And I had no idea that I'd go from being a therapist to a speaker to working on TV to even speaking on the news. I mean, I was speaking on the news about why Gordon Blair was going to be elected. And I didn't really know what I was doing, but they were asking me to read all their body language. So I did know that. And I remember thinking, wow, that's, here am I, you know, on the news talking about politics. And that you should say yes to everything. I mean, certain things I said yes to didn't work out at all. But then you see, I always think that failure is your friend. I was asked to be a television presenter and I was terrible at it. And I just couldn't do it. The energy you have to get. I just talk about a banana muffin, like it was so interesting. I think, oh, yeah, this is really, it hasn't got my name on it at all. No, but I realized then that wasn't my skill set. It wasn't my gift. So when it didn't work out, I didn't feel terrible. I thought, oh, that's really not for me. I'm actually glad I had that chance to realize that I was so awful at it. I didn't have that energy, that enthusiasm, that you could switch on something so exciting about something that to me was meaningless. I have great respect for people who do.
Talking about saying yes and jumping into things, as we're all sat in Dubai, and a lot of people are moving to Dubai and want to move to Dubai, and they're taking the plunge, and they're trying to expand their business and grow in this region. And as you may know, it's this region's very unique. You have to treat it as its own place. You can't hey, I'm building this business in the UK, I'm going to take that same playbook and apply it to Dubai. So this region, you know, it's a new region. You're trying to navigate it as a business owner. you've got the additional costs from schooling, if you've got family, you know, it can be quite daunting. And for that entrepreneur, they're telling themselves this story about and seeing they're being worried, but also excited at the same time. But that worry creeps in, you know? What would you say to that individual that's got this big aspiration, a passion about their business, but at the same time, they're worried about this figure?
Yeah, and there's something called WPO, the worst possible outcome. And statistically, a lot of stuff you worry about never happens. It's very easy to go, you know, this, what if it goes wrong? What if it doesn't work? What if, you know, it's that great speech that Marion Williamson wrote for Nelson Mandela about who are you to hide your light? Aren't you supposed to shine it? So you have to have phenomenal self-belief. Again, that's the driver, even more than talent, is phenomenal, extraordinary self-belief. That will take you everywhere. So if you've come here with a vision, you've got to always keep your vision in mind. You know, what is my goal? Where do I want to go? And every day, what steps do I have to take to get me to my goal? And then you have to keep taking the steps. And of course, you know, we change in three ways. Some people change like that. We all love the instant changes, but many people change over time, you know, cumulatively, bit by bit. And a lot of us change retroactively. So there's a lag time into what you do and the results you see. But I would say one of the best things is to keep going on to you, to keep buying books of people. What did they do? What did they do to make it? Well, how are they different to you? A lot of it is persistence, determination, networking, who can help you. And you have to keep going. And it's very easy to give up. But in a world where there's so much available, so many tutorials that say, I did this, so many great books of what happened, you know, join a peer group. You know, when my first book, I couldn't get it signed, and I joined a peer group. And a peer group is great because your chance of succeeding goes up by 80% if someone holds you accountable. So one of the best things you can do is find an accountability buddy or join a group of people and get them to hold you. I'm going to do this. And then, of course, you go back for the next meeting and they go, did you do it? And so I said, okay, I'm going to self-publish my book and I'm going to put on a talk and I'm going to put on this talk and then I'm going to write my own book and I'm going to go all around the country and I'm going to just sell the book myself. But I had a peer group and they said, and I knew, I said, okay, I'm going to put on the talk between now and our next meeting. I think they were every 2 months. And I put on this talk and not many people had bought tickets and I was just about to cancel. In fact, I did cancel. I canceled it. And then this agent called and said, hey, I'm sending Google and HarperCollins, were all coming to this talk. I said, okay, I should put it back on. So I quickly put it back on. I gave all the tickets away free. And HarperCollins and Penguin turned up. And Hache gave me a huge, massive book deal on the spot when I finished that talk. But I wouldn't have done that, Doug, if I hadn't had this accountability group who said, okay, you said you're going to do it. When you come out, you must have either done it or at least got the day in your day. And one of the people there bought a ticket for him and his wife, so I had to do it. But having an accountability body to hold you accountable massively extends your success because you think, oh, I can't let them down now. It's like if you're going for a run or going to the gym with a person, you do it more than, oh, I really don't want to go. Mm-hmm. So if you're out here and you want to make it, join as many groups as you can. I mean, not too many, but join supportive groups, join networks, join people that can help you, guide you, but especially that can hold you accountable. And then you'll go further. And again, you can't know what your potential is. It expands. But also, once you go to a new dimension with a mind, it never goes back again. So when you do those difficult things, make those difficult calls. Once now you've moved your mind to a dimension that won't go back because it's got familiar with doing difficult stuff.
Yeah, I had this experience actually yesterday. With a guy I was introduced to. I didn't even ask for the introduction. And often in Dubai, I don't know if this has happened to you, Katie, as well, is someone will go, yeah, you need to meet this other person. And you don't know why you're meeting them, but you're just, you turn up to coffee. And I met this guy and he said, I really like what you do, but I think you're doing a few things wrong. And I said, love it. Tell me what I'm doing wrong. Just, I'm very open. And I was like, just, And I said, What I would do, though, is I would rephrase it and say there's opportunities. There's opportunity. Mm. And he sat there for an hour with me. I said, what do you want, by the way, from this? What can I give you? How can I help you? I said, no. And he just turned around and said, no, I just want to help. I just love helping entrepreneurs, and I've been in the journey. And he just shared and poured into me a number of things. And he said at the end, he said, look, you need to think about this very simply, and here's what you need to target. Mm-hmm. And all my thoughts and all my confusion and all the ideas I had in my head just disappeared. Mm-hmm. And now I had this accountability buddy.
Yeah.
And I had this target. Mm. And I left that meeting. And he said, because I would be a customer. And I told you that this morning. He said that to me. And he said, it's 5 hours now and you still haven't taken my money.
Mm.
And I love that. And
yeah.
I think the idea of an accountability group is, there's so much value in it.
Yeah, get an accountability group and then again, go back and look at the five things. There's seven actually that successful do all the time. The first is they do what they really dislike. But they do it, and they do it first. They don't think, I'll do that later. Yeah. And then they take action on their waist every day in the direction of the goals. They do something. It might be on my day off, I'm just going to watch a YouTube tutorial or send one email. But they take on the way to success, they take action every day. When they've made it, they have a lot of time off. They are really good at giving themselves praise. They don't outsource that. They delay gratification, which is really important because, you know, our brain is wired to work rewards. So we go to school, we do a lesson, we get playtime. We come home and our parents say, finish your homework and you go out to play. So our brain is wired to work and then take the reward. And so if you think, okay, I'm going to come in and I got these emails and I got this lovely dinner on my favorite, I'm going to do the emails and then the dinner is going to be my reward. Watching my show is my reward. I've got to wake up and make these little rewards, but then I'm going to have half an hour speaking to a friend or having a wonderful breakfast. As if you take the reward without doing the work, it's like giving a dog a bone that's always fed. It doesn't even know what to do with it, but it knows it's supposed to bury it and dig it up, but it's very confusing. So you have to delay gratification. And the other thing, of course, is to give yourself goals. But tell everyone that you're good. I'm good at this. This is my gift. This is my unique skill set. You know, we think people won't like it, but I was flying back from LA once in a flight that really hit turbulence, and the pilot said, don't worry, I happen to be BA's best pilot. No matter what he's there, I went, thank God for that.
Yeah, the best.
You know, when you go to a school or a doctor or a restaurant here in Dubai, it's like, which is the best restaurant? Which is the best school? Which is the best place to live? So we're also scared of being the best, and yet being the best makes other people confident. We like the best. So if you were to adopt all of those seven habits and had an accountability body, it's almost impossible not to stop yourself going to success because it also starts to come to you. So what you are moving towards will move towards you. What you want wants you. And of course, the universe does work in a certain way. You think of something and suddenly you're sitting next to a publisher.
Mm.
As you say, you thought of something and suddenly you met someone who wanted to help you. And there are a lot of people out there who do want. There's lots of groups and clubs and people. My husband does that all the time. You know, he's such a clever marketer and he's always giving advice and helping people. But also people are always giving advice to him and they have lots of breakfasts and brunches and lunches here. Go to the ones that, if you don't like it, go to another one. But
yeah,
also hang out with people that can help you, that have not so much where you are, but where you want to go. Ask, and don't be scared of asking people to give you some time or to recommend the book or the program that changed their life, because there's so many of them. Yeah. Then look at someone's reading list and think, I'm going to read that. You know, I met Mo Gadol this week and he went, I'm such a fan. I'm like, oh, really? Because I'm such a fan. Really? So we were fanning each other. I was amazed he was my fan because I was such a fan of him and what he's done and the books he's written, which are amazing. But here is such a great world to meet people. You know, never be scared of an opportunity. I was listening to Stephen Bartlett. Listen to Stephen Bartlett interviewing Joe Dispenza, and he happened to say to Joe, you know, really upsets me that I'm so messy and I can't give up sugar. And I thought Joe, being as good as he would say, let me fix that. But he didn't. Mm-hmm. He said something like, I think you might be addicted to the drama. And I remember thinking,
much as I admire Joe Dispenza, he missed a trick there, but maybe he didn't need to. So I called Stephen and said, hey, Stephen, I just watched that. And you know, I could fix that for you in 20 minutes. Do you want me to come on the show? Because, of course, that's what I used to do, ring people up. And he said, yeah, I'd love that.
You still do that?
I still do it. So he called me on the show, he went on the show, and I did some hypnosis, fixed it.
It's incredible.
And then somebody from Healdrop said, hey, could you come on my show and do that? And someone else said, can you come on my show? And all of a sudden, I'm going now, I think, okay, I'll now reinvent it. Instead of going on a blog, I'll go on a blog and I'll do some RTD and fix people on the blog.
But this is when I get my shopping list out of all the things that I need to be fixed.
So it's them live on camera.
Success comes from, you know, thinking outside the box, taking a step. I mean, I wouldn't have thought of doing that, but I thought, you know, I should fix him. That's crazy that he's still bothered by that. And so when you see something, you just got to take a leap of faith and, you know, it didn't actually occur to me it might not work, which is probably a good thing.
But it absolutely did, didn't it? Because I watched Danae, he did a look back, and it was his addiction to sugar, wasn't it? And he looked visibly better 3 weeks later.
And if your other girl said, hey, I watched that, I closed my eyes when you used it, and it fixed me. So we were right, he was saying, I did the same thing as you did, Stephen. I closed my eyes when you were fixing my sugar thing, and it's fixed it.
So over here, you're fixing people.
Yeah.
And as business owners, entrepreneurs, leaders, you're fixing problems, you're working, you're hustling, you're trying to, you're being held accountable to reach your goals. And then it hits 6 o'clock and you're now on your way home and you've got kids, as we do, or, you know, you have a wife or a partner and you have to switch off. And I personally really struggle with that. Detaching myself from I was about to say hard day, but now I'm questioning myself from the storm I'm heading myself, but from the on fire day that I had, and trying to be there present with the kids and the family.
Oh.
How do you do that?
It is a choice. You have to kind of say to them, okay, when I go to work, I'm 100% at work. I'm 100%. I work with a lot of footballers, and we say this word narrow down. When I go on the pitch, I say the word narrow down. And nothing exists except the game, getting that ball, getting the ball in the back of the net. And I don't think about anything. Because a lot of them, I'm not thinking about my girlfriend, I'm thinking about something else. So they have to say the word narrow down. And as a writer, you have to go, okay, when I pick up my pen or when I put everything narrows down except for the work. So as a business owner, you see, when I go to work, even when I get in the car, I'm just 100% at work. I'm 100% at work. I give everything I've got. When I shut the door and I go home and I open the door with my kids, I'm 100% a dad. I'm just putting work out of my mind. It's a very smart thing to do, you know, because in the days of phones and computers, you can be at work 7 days a week, even on a plane. Oh, look, I'll just answer that email. So you do have to make a choice. I'm at work from 9 to 6, or from 7 to 8, or I'm just with my kids, I'm just with my partner, I'm just in the gym, I'm just lying on the sofa chilling, watching Breaking Bad. I'm not constantly looking at my phone. So you have to compartmentalize yourself. And people who are very good will say, I'm so good at work. But when I come home, I don't answer the phone. I don't look at emails.
That takes huge discipline, I think.
And it doesn't work for everybody. You know, for me, when I'm in the back of a car, I like looking at my phone. Think, oh, God, I just get rid of them as they come in. But I also know, as a parent, when you're with your children, you have to put everything away because it really hurts them that you're looking at you. And they'll say, Mommy, you're still on your phone. So you have to think, you know, what is the outcome here? I want to be a great parent. And if I know the outcome, then the outcome is for 2 hours, don't look at the phone. My daughter said to me, Mommy, where are your grandmothers? You always argue. I thought, you know, she's right. What is the outcome of going to visit my mum with? To have a great time. And then when my daughter said that, I just stopped arguing with her because I thought, that's so silly. It's ruining it for my daughter. But just keep in your head, what is the outcome? Do I want to be a great parent? Do I want to be a really, you know, all your kids ever want is for you to be present with them. That's the only thing they want ever, be present with them. And that's actually not really hard. I wished I'd known that when my daughter was younger, but I know it now. Be present, put everything down. It can be hard, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't do it because it's hard. You know, doing sit-ups is hard.
Yeah, well, I had this conversation this morning with someone and I asked him, I said, well, from a business point of view, what's your number one project? And he said, my son. And it threw me.
Yeah.
You know, here I'm talking about business. And he said, my number one project is my son. And then it's my business.
Yeah, the greatest investment.
Yeah.
It was like,
you know, that's such a great answer, such a great story to tell yourself.
Sure. But if you just keep remembering, you know, all your kids want is to be present, probably your clients too. But if you know that's what they want, you know, that's a great thing about business. When you know what your customers want, you can deliver it. And when you know what your kids want, you can deliver it. And in business, you know, our clients want something that will lessen their pain point. If you have a product that will lessen someone's pain point, then you're going to do really well. Everything we buy it because of how it makes us feel. So if you have something you can sell, makes people feel good, you'll always be okay. But as a parent, you're going to lessen your kids' pain point and make them feel good by being present. And now you've got to think of it as a job. Okay, I got a job. I know my job description. I'm an entrepreneur, I'm an inventor, I'm a writer. I'm a strategist. You say, my job for 2 hours is to be fully present with my kids. It's my job. And I got a mission to do that job really well. And also, if you give yourself a time, it's just for like 2 hours or an hour, just to be present, just to listen. And it then you can be good at that job too. Because many people say, you know, we have a belief when I'm really successful at business, my kids suffer. If I'm a really great parent, my business suffers. Because we believe we can't have it all. But you can have it all. You can have it all the time if you just remember, okay, say the words, narrow down, and for 2 hours, totally present with these kids. Because the time for 8 hours, totally present with that client. And then you go, when this too will pass, it doesn't last long. So I would say just remember, all they want is for you to be present with them.
I feel like I'm having a therapy session right now. This is exactly yeah. what I needed to hear.
Of course.
Right now.
Sure.
But let's go tactical on the marketing side.
Mm-hmm.
You produce a lot of content.
I do.
And your first video on YouTube, I believe, was about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And then I think you slowed down. And then 3-4 years ago, you had this big sprint.
Mm.
And then just looking at recently, you're publishing 3-4 videos a week. You're not someone that is that has built this great businesses and now is letting this business grow by itself. You're picking up the phone to Stephen Bartlett and still in hustle mode.
Mm.
There's many questions there, but where I want to start here is really, what's your content strategy? And just look at your recent content. I don't know how much you look at your views, but you know, 2 days ago you had a video that had 24,000 views,
mm-hmm.
and then recently the video was maybe 4,000 or 5,000 views.
Mm.
So, what's your overall content strategy? Do you care about the numbers? Do you feel like that instant gratification that we're always looking for? Around views, likes, comments, you know, getting that engagement. What's your overall mindset and strategy?
So my mindset, again, is lessen people's pain point. What message or story could I do to lessen someone's pain point? Is there something I could do to make someone feel good? So I understand that everything we want is because it makes us feel good. And all the therapists are trying to say, listen, this is your job. You've got to give every person you're seeing freedom and empowerment. When you know what your job is, that's the job that give your clients freedom and empowerment. So I know my job, my message is to how can I lessen your pain point? How can I make you feel good? How can I give you freedom and empowerment? And I do look at the numbers. And we just did this 12 days of Christmas. And I was like, well, it could have been better. It was good. Could have been better. I could see immediately what I had a different person filming. I could see immediately what hadn't worked. But I didn't feel bad. I thought, you know, I know next time. To do better. And I look at stuff and some stuff is amazing and some isn't. But of course, that's all a learning curve. What do people like? You know, now there's like 3 minutes or they like a minute. You know, they want very, very quick stuff. They want it to be very snappy. They want a message. And it's quite hard to get a message across in a minute. It's not impossible. And I think, again, we're always learning. You know, people have got a short attention span. There's a lot of people doing similar stuff to what I do. How can you stay relevant? How can you get your message across? But the best thing is, how can I make someone feel good? And somebody wrote to me and said, you know, you're the only person that says anything nice to me all week. It's only you. You're the only person that says something kind to me. I thought, isn't that amazing? I don't even know this girl. But she's now got me as the person that says nice things to her. that is kind to her. And so I love that. I know that someone somewhere who will say to me, no, I heard this thing you talked about, this thing you talked about being enough, and it changed my life. And people come up to me all the time and say, oh, you changed my life, or you said this or did that. And so the numbers are important because I know it's working. But even if I had lower numbers, I'd still go on doing it because, you know, in the Torah and indeed the Quran, it says if you can change one person's life, that's the same as changing everyone's life. And so it shouldn't be about how many people have I reached, just have I reached one person and made them feel better? Because again, that again is meaning and purpose. If someone somewhere has a better life because of a skill you have, then that's a good thing. And that could be, you've created a product. Like for me, you know, when I bought Dyson hairdryer, that changed my life because I can now dry my hair in 4 minutes flat and then just leave the house. And I was telling my friend who was going, oh my God, in lockdown, I said, just get a Dyson. It's worth every penny. Because, you know, and of course, Dyson wasn't evolutionary. He was revolutionary, but he took something that was already there. He's one of the richest people in the UK, but he hasn't created a thing. He's taken someone else's products and improved them. He's improved fans, hand dryers, vacuum cleaners, and hair dryers. So you don't have to invent anything. You can just take an existing product and improve it. Can this lessen someone's pain point?
Where do you think,
can I make this better?
And where do you get your inspiration behind your content? You know, that often when we're speaking to clients, they'll say, I just don't know what to talk about. I know I want to be present. I know I want to be out there, but I don't really know what to talk about. Well, once I've done these four topics, what do I share? And then there's you. Shooting your first video, still churning out great content that's getting an amazing amount of reach. And you're still talking about that same area.
Yeah. So I think you can talk about the same thing. You can rehash it, but change it a bit. But there's always more, you know. Where do I get it from? I read the paper. I follow the news. I look at what's going on in the world. And I look at what's making people unhappy. And the big thing is disconnection. Disconnection, self-critical, you know, being mean to ourselves. And the biggest cause of depression is harsh, hurtful, critical words that you say about yourself. And then at the moment it's seasonal, you know, it's Christmas, the pressure to buy all this stuff, and maybe then it's going to be Valentine's Day and I don't have anyone who loves me. And it's Mother's Day and I don't have a baby, or I'm a terrible parent. And then it's, oh my God, I got to get this beach body. And then it's something else. It's Diwali, then it's Halloween, then it's Thanksgiving, then it's Christmas again. So I just look at what is going on with people. Why are we unhappy? You know, we have more than our grandparents ever had, and yet we're more dissatisfied. Women apparently have less sex than their grandmothers had. And I look at, you know, every year there's a new way to hate your body. There's the bikini bridge and the thigh gap and the A3 challenge. And people are getting overexposed every day to fake images of perfection. And then it takes a matter, I don't feel enough. So my real message is you are enough. You'll always be enough. You always have been just the way you are. It doesn't mean you can't improve yourself. But I think, you know, my audience, I get a new audience of younger people, really young people. Then I get my older audience might move on. They might come back. A lot of people say, you know, my kids listen to you. They love you. So I think you have to be relevant. But I think you just have to understand, why are people dissatisfied? They're more dissatisfied with themselves and with their life. And then you think, well, why are they dissatisfied? But a lot of that is down to social media peddling these fake images of reality.
A non-person.
Yeah, which is a thief of joy. And so my message is really very simple. It's, hey, you're great and you can be greater and you're good and you matter and you've got something to offer the world. I mean, it's not, I don't do really deep, hardcore stuff. It's, why don't you believe in you? What would it take for you to believe in you? And could you believe in you and have an amazing life?
And it's often saying the same thing, but saying it a different way, because you know you'll connect with someone else by saying it this way, and you'll connect with another individual saying another way.
Yeah. Yeah, and I love the fact that I've got grandmothers and 11-year-olds all saying, wow, what you said was a game changer. And I'm certainly not the only person saying what I say, but I think my USP is that I make it very simple.
Yeah.
People haven't got time for anything. They don't want to hear about the frontal cortex of your mind or...
You'll leave that for a session.
All they want to know is, can I feel better? Can you make me feel good? Every doctor, every dentist, every shop, can you make me feel good? And the answer is, yeah, I really can, but so can you. You can feel really good if you could just learn to praise yourself. If you could just learn to up the praise and lower the destructive criticism, that would change your life. So, that's the thing I love the most, that it's simple little tiny hacks, but they have massive, massive... Nobody's got time to write 100 goals out every day, do 100 sit-ups, or, do all this stuff. People have got a few minutes. And so the I'm enough, and we're just saying, writing it on your mirror, writing it on your hand, putting it on your screensaver, making bracelets and saying it. So I think we keep coming up with simple things.
I love the simplicity behind it. I was expecting, we run this research, we then do this strategy. My husband then, some competition, he didn't say any of that.
No.
It was just, we know how we help someone.
We know
the outcome that they want. Talk about that outcome. And we share it in different ways. I love that. That line there.
Because recently I was putting some lotion on my skin. I was thinking, what am I doing? I'm just putting lotion on my skin. And of course it's going in, but my skin can't say, is that paraben free? Is it super organic fair trade? Or did you get that free on an airplane that's full of chemicals? It's all going to go in. And your thoughts are like lotion. They go in. And just as the lotion nourishes you from the inside, because lotion is balm for dried skin, but words are balm for a dried soul. And you just got to be aware that your mind can no more reject your words than your skin can reject body lotion. It's all going to go in, whether it's toxic or super healthy.
Mm.
And so we just have to be aware, what are we presenting to our mind? It's all going in. And why not just present it something better? Because it will go in anyway. That's very good.
Beautiful.
Good way to...
Yeah. So as we close out, from the outside in, you have this thriving community. You've got a successful business. You're this successful person that's a renowned speaker, bestseller. You're now in Dubai for the last few months. What's next for Marissa Peer?
I think the big thing about coming to Dubai was to put our program into the school system. But our second big thing is it's not a diet, we have something called Dietless Life, which is all the mentality and the mindset about dieting and self-hatred and how abusive diets are. And of course, the Middle East, as you know, has got a challenging problem with having overweight children, which is so sad. So we want to have that program here too. So we've got a school program, which is everything. We've got our anti-diet program. And then, of course, I've got 120 people I trained already work in the UAE as successful therapists. And we've got our first ever school in Dubai in February, training people from this region to have what I know is the best job in the world. Because the best job in the world is when you can change someone's life. And, of course, the lovely thing is if you're changing someone else's life, you can't do that without changing your own. So having our school here, our first one in February, is so exciting.
It sounds like you're going to be very busy.
Yeah. But I do get to do what I told you to do. I can be fully present with something else. I know when to switch off. I call it take. You're like a battery. If you keep charging your phone for a minute, you have to switch it off and leave it and let it charge for a while. So you do have to do a lot of recharging when you're very busy, just taking time out. Remember, you're a human being, not a human doing. And that means sometimes you just got to be and not do.
A human being and not a human doing.
Yeah.
Well, what a way to end this podcast. I feel like we've got so many quotes that I need to actually download them all, put it on my wall.
Thank you
so much for being part of the podcast. It's been so great having you here.
Before we close out, we had a question from membership.
Oh, yes.
Somebody who's, I think, on your program or will be on your program in February. So it's an inside question.
Okay.
Yes. So the question is from Flora Castillon. How do you see RTT, Rapid Transformation Therapy, being implemented into the workplace?
I mean, I think it's the best therapy in the world. I think it's fast, it's cutting edge. It And clients tell me this is the most amazing thing. And we already have a lot of corporates using. We have a lot of people in the corporate world using. Actually, out here, we've been asked to take it into so many companies. We have quite a few big companies who have their own RTT therapists working for the company because they too have people who can't lead, who can't present, who can't speak, who we have that chronic thing in business where the top people have all these different illnesses and it costs companies a lot of money. And they're realizing, the corporate world's realizing, if you can provide therapy for your staff, you know, I've worked with traders helping them to trade better. I've worked on with all kinds of issues. But I think the corporate world is waking up to the fact that you can't medicate. You know, one of my favorite expressions is when you don't fix your wounds, you bleed on people who never cut you. And that's important. You've got to fix your wounds early so you don't bleed on the wrong people. And you don't need to medicate. You know, my favorite quote in the whole world is that the feeling that cannot find its expression in tears will cause other organs to weep. And that's what happens when you can't work out what's hurting you or bugging you or eating away at you. It just leaks out. But if you can fix at the core what's going on, because the corporate world lose so much money in absenteeism because people eat terribly, they don't get enough sleep, they don't get enough rest, they're always stressed. And if you can fix all of those things, which you can with RTT very quickly, the bottom end is they make more money. They have happy staff, they make more money.
I feel like everyone needs to listen to this podcast.
I hope they do.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Marissa. Yeah,
thank you, Marissa. Really, really. Pleasure.
Yeah, it's been amazing. And where should people go check you out? You've got so many profiles. Where do you want them to go?
Go to marissapeer.com. We have a lot of totally free stuff. We have free audios on wealth blocks, health blocks, love blocks. It says all free. Just go and take those. And if you want to train in RTT, you want to come on our course in Dubai in February, then go to rtt.com to find out about the training. You want to find someone who I've trained who could fix all of your issues really quickly. So marissapeer.com and rtt.com.
Brilliant. There you go. Thank you so much, Marissa.